Well, wait till you hear some of the new Spiritcom audio clips are going to play later on this hour. Our guest is Dr. Stephen Rourke, and we'll be back with him more and talk to him about his research on Coast to Coast AM. Stephen, what would these individuals who are working with Spiritcom, what would they gain to create fraud? I mean, were they making money on this? What were they doing?
Well, that, therein lies the rational need for just a step-by-step research approach that that this current investigation has run through. First, I mean, the recognition of a mystery, the formulation of models or hypotheses to explain it, gathering new facts, new documentation like you've just heard, even experimentation on our own to attempt to reproduce those sounds that were found on the Spiritcom tape, and then continue to form new hypotheses to try to account for the continued high strangeness in the story. So ultimately, I think it comes down to motivation, and this requires multiple models to explain it. I don't, let's say, have a pet theory about it, but I can tell you that there was the potential for a monetary motive, even though the materials were never patented, copyrighted, or trademarked. So it seems a little incongruous to the listener, I understand, when they say, well, wait a second, this stuff was free and was offered up to researchers. How could there have possibly been a monetary motive? That's a really good question, but if you look just past the mythology of Spiritcom into some of the primary source documents, you find that the MetaScience Foundation had an operating budget that I can document for at least 2 years. Now, I cannot speak for the rest of the years from primary source documentation, but
okay.
I have a memorandum from the internal files of MetaScience that states they had an operational budget of $250,000 per year, and this is 1980 money. 1981
That's
money.
Huge money. That was all what, donations?
Well, that's therein lies some of the mystery, the continued mystery of Spiritcom, because, George, $250,000 doesn't explain, it doesn't come close to explaining the expenditures on a, let's say, a modified sideband radio, which is basically what Spiritcom was in the end.
And once you make it, your expenses generally should stop.
Ah, and maybe even a profit motive is there, because in Alexander McRae's book, EVP and New Dimensions, McRae was an intimate of George Meek's, and George Meek visited McRae on the Isle of Skye, and McRae recounts his receiving a flyer for a Spiritcom for sale by the MetaScience Research Foundation for $10,000.
Well, we will open up the phone lines later tonight, and maybe someone out there has one of these things. Wouldn't that be interesting,
yeah,
Stephen?
That would be cool. And in fact, I can. I'm going to have to save this for later, but I can even tell folks where the actual Spiritcom device is. This is one of the enduring mysteries involved in Spiritcom. Is, hey, if it was real in any sense, Rourke, you know, where is the stuff today? Was it absconded? You know, through some covert intelligence operation to hide it from us. And no, I know where it is, but I do believe there are potential psychological operation models that might apply to some of the high strangeness around this, just some of the high strangeness being this money issue we've just raised.
Okay, and the players again, George Meek, he was the developer of Spiritcom.
Well, essentially,
right?
Well, yes, he was the... let's say he was the benefactor to William O'Neill, who developed the Spiritcom. Now, the Spiritcom itself, Mark IV, indicates that there must have been Marks 1 through 3, and there were. There were other versions of the Spiritcom device. But essentially, the one that purportedly yielded the greatest success, these 20 hours plus of conversations with a supposedly deceased NASA scientist, those were with the Mark IV device. So in a way, you could say that Meek... also developed Spiritcom in a way. But the Mark IV was almost entirely William O'Neill's creation, a self-proclaimed psychic medium and, you know, offbeat mystic who intuitively would guide himself through the creation of technological devices to communicate with otherworldly realms.
All right. In Mueller, was the alleged spirit voice contacted? Was he the only voice they contacted?
No, and this is very interesting. It leads to a question about William O'Neill. William O'Neill communicated through the early Mark IV, like the prototypical Spiracom. He communicated with a Doc Nick. He communicated with another individual named Frank Engstrom, who was supposedly from circa 1800s in Virginia. Now, there are some inconsistencies which are glaring when you hear the we won't hear the Engstrom audio tonight because it's so grating, and O'Neill's voice is so distant because it's so prototypical in its recording and performance. But it's interesting to note that Fred and Doc were communicated with supposedly before Dr. George Jeffries Mueller, a deceased NASA scientist. And the reason I say it's interesting is because you remember earlier I made what might have seemed like an unfair characterization of William O'Neill as a schizophrenic. Well, it just so happens that my primary source investigations have brought me to documents relating to the mental health status of Bill O'Neill, the developer of the Spiracom, the man operating the device. O'Neill was a mentally disturbed individual who also had, listen to this, a ventriloquist's skill set. And we know this to be true because he performed a children's show while he lived in Cincinnati, and we know this to be true by his interview with John Fuller, and we know that this actually occurred and was not just some fantasy of his, because I have found a screen capture image of O'Neill dressed in his cowboy uniform with a puppet on his lap, and that image can be found on spiracomstudy.com, and so can some of these clips from tonight. And that establishes him as having a ventriloquist skill set. But how about his mental health status? Well, it's relayed in Fuller's book, The Ghost of 29 Megacycles, that O'Neill is a manic who sought psychological treatment. I found by way of Meta Science Files and an obit that William O'Neill died in Torrance State Medical Facility. It was a mental hospital in Deary, Pennsylvania. He died under care for schizophrenia. And now, compounding this scenario now is findings from studies done in academia about schizophrenics, and these studies of schizophrenics find that it is quite common in schizophrenics that the names Doc and Fred are names schizophrenics commonly use to identify imagined entities they interact with. And I remind the listeners that Doc, Nick, and Fred Engstrom were among the first contacts O'Neill made using that prototypical Spiracom technology.
Okay, now, if I'm hearing you right, you're saying that EVPs could be real. We don't know where they're coming from. Spiracom, your jury's out on that, but it sounds like you don't think it's real.
Ah, yes. I'd like to make one, just with one caveat. Everything you said is correct, except I have come to a conclusion of fraud regarding Spiracom, but maybe not the fraud a lot of folks would think, because I'm willing to entertain the idea that William O'Neill was not a mentally ill person who perpetrated a hoax. He could have been mentally ill, and this could have been a self-deception that was interpreted as real by others. It could even have been the chicken before the egg question. Was O'Neill driven insane by something resulting in the Spiracom sessions, or was he already crazy? And
I wonder if he was possessed or something like that, Stephen. You never know.
Well, yeah, I mean, I couldn't go that far, but in some of the Spiracom-related literature, people have kind of hypothesized that as an explanation for his later erratic behavior and detention in a mental health facility. So all this comes back again to that model I proposed earlier. It's a simple scientific model of, you know, finding a mystery, formulating a hypothesis, finding new facts and experimentation, and then seeing if it all checks out. Well, under that simple model, two things must be done then. You must take the background of the players and always go back to the evidence. And the most testable evidence we have here is not the mental health status of Bill O'Neill, because though we have documents relating to it, Bill O'Neill is deceased. What we do still have, though, is those Spiricom tapes. Now, it sounded to both of us like it might have been an electrolarynx, but the problem is, how does one perform, even if you are a ventriloquist, how does one pull off this back and forth? Because if people have ever seen an electrolarynx be used, it's when used properly, it's put up against the throat. This would appear to be a slightly different sound quality and would allow for a lot of movement in William O'Neill, which essentially we don't see when he's operating the device in the video. So enter Dr. David Rivers, who replicates the Spiricom effect using an electrolarynx device incorrectly. He uses the device in front of his lips so that the oral cavity and of William O'Neill could have been modulating the sound. In other words, mouthing the sound rather than throwing your voice, still technically a ventriloquist-type skill set being employed, but using the device in an incorrect way. And, boy, is Rivers' audio compelling. It sounds, I mean, the listeners have to make their minds up themselves, but it sounds a lot like the Spiricom device.
Let's listen to it.
Now, I'm going to read a brief passage for you with the electrolarynx held in front of my lips.
Now, what's interesting and needs to be brought into this piece of evidence right here is the fact that in the Spiricom manual, Meek himself stated, people will claim that this is ventriloquism. So this was either a subtle knowing that he came out and stated as to take this this confirming piece of evidence away from debunkers, a kind of preservation of beliefs that Meek might have taken. We know Meek's knew all about O'Neill's ventriloquism mastery. He knew all about that because O'Neill had told him about this many times in his he recounts it in his own books, in fact, George Meek. Also, what needs to be brought to bear upon this is a reminder that while you may Google the Spiricom manual, the technical manual, not in every manual out there, but in the manual I have, the first printing on page 30, it states that the MetaScience organization was in possession of an electrolarynx device.
Uh-huh.
Now, how are we to say, though, that O'Neill possessed the device? Well, there's two ways to do that. One is to either say David Rivers lays out such a compelling comparison as to say, hey, this has got to be it, it's case closed. You could also go to the modern day, the current president of MetaScience. He was bequeathed the mantle by George Meek himself, and he's the head of MetaScience. His name is Thomas Pratt. And Thomas Pratt has relayed to me that part of the manifest, part of the actual components and electronic equipment he has in a facility housing all the old Spiricom devices is an electrolarynx. But someone could still argue, listening to that, that the quality is not quite exact. So is there anything else, is there any other technology of the day that might approximate that Spiricom sound? That might have been, let's say, a little less cost prohibitive. I mean, after all, it could be that O'Neill did not possess the electrolarynx device, that George Meek conceded to having in his possession as early as 1979 as part of the Metascience equipment. So a much cheaper device that could almost replicate the same Spiracom sound is found in an old talk box. People know it from the Peter Frampton songs and things like this. It's often called a Frampton device. So in 2006, I contracted a producer to create a Spiracom effect. This was an open-ended challenge, and again, this is science, is testing the falsifiability of evidence. I simply sent Tim Loud some...
And he was a producer, right?
Yes, a producer with a variety of vintage equipment, okay? I sent him just a few Spiracom clips and said, if you were in 1980, how would you recreate this sound? So he had no context for this beyond what he was hearing. And in fact, he conceded that he thought it might have been ham radio except for the Frampton device-like sound effect. And so we have now a way to triangulate, a way to explain through multiple technologies of the day, and this current one being a little bit cheaper. You could have gotten a talk box in 1980 for about $100 from a music store. So the track you're about to play is actually a very contemporary confirmation of David Rivers' findings, except Dr. Rivers was using an electrolarynx.
Okay, we'll hear this one now. We're going to play some other tracks when we come back from the break. Now, you know what? These are weird, Stephen, aren't they?
Oh, they have a strange quality, which I think is what made them compelling to paranormal enthusiasts. Even to this day, as we said, it kind of spawned the ITC EVP contemporary field of research.
You know what? I was going to say I'm dying to find out some more conclusions about your EVP, but I don't want to end up on any of your voice tracks.
Oh no, don't invite any of that.
No, not at all.
You know, what would be great though, George, is when we come back, people can hear a compare contrast, a side by side, clip after clip analysis of the Spiracom O'Neill Mueller interaction, the David Rivers Dr. Rivers audio larynx, and the Tim Loud Frampton device, a side-by-side of them saying the same things, and they can judge if they're not so close as to give really a means by which these could have been falsified. So we might want to consider them as a hoax.
Why do the EVP sounds always seem so angry? You don't really get a lot of friendly ones. I mean, there's always some hostility going on.
It does seem that they're full of character, and this could, again, be apophenia or auditory pareidolia. It could be our interpretation of these things, because our context for finding EVPs, right, is that these are, you know, the voices of dead people is the fairly obvious hypothesis for most weekend ghost hunters. So the expectation to be fulfilled is that it might be some, you know, malevolent spirit.
Okay, back with more of your research, Stephen Rourke, and more of these incredible tracks when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. For a limited time, we're offering two CDs of Art Bell's old interviews with the late Father Malachi Martin. If you own one of these, we did this campaign a few years ago, but now we're giving you two. They're two different ones. Well, you can keep them both, give one away as a gift. When you subscribe or renew your After Dark magazine, simply go to coasttocoastam.com to do that. Or call 1-888-727-5505. That's 1-888-727-5505. Let's listen to some of the rest of these tracks, Stephen, while we have time remaining this half hour. And then I want to get your impressions on the Spiricom and then dive into EVPs, and then we'll take phone calls next hour, okay?
Well, sounds good. As long as we can get to some of those more interesting
psychological
operations models.
Absolutely. Okay, perfect. Now let's talk about this next one that you talked about, which was the contrast comparison.
Yeah, this is perfect for the audience because we can't really expect people to remember, let's say, an hour ago what the Spiricom sounded like. So this is just a less than half a minute. It's a side-by-side comparison, a stringer, if you will, of the following three clips. It is the O'Neill Mueller Spiricom, then the Dr. Rivers replication using an electrolarynx device, then the Tim Loud device, the Frampton device as reproduced by Tim Loud. And all the levels were equalized by Brian Jones, and this is a really tight presentation, so I think the audience will be able to draw a conclusion from this. I'm not telling them what to think, but this sure will give them something to think about.
All right, here we are. They're all pretty close.
Yeah, they are. If it's not, in other words, if it's not one, the electrolarynx, it could have been the other less expensive device of its day, the Frampton device, available at guitar stores at the time. And O'Neill, I contend, was such a handy guy. You could even make one. All you need is like a resonance chamber with a tube that you could kind of put your lips in approximation of the tube and through your oral cavity modulate the sound. It might also explain the guy who put this stringer together, Brian Jones, made an interesting observation. He noticed that this discarnate voice, the dead Dr. Mueller, doesn't really call Bill O'Neill Bill O'Neill, because Bill O'Neill would be too difficult to say with the punctuated B of Bill. Rather, it's always William, and if people notice that it's easier to say William if they would attempt to mouth it right now, there might be a good reason why the entirety of the Spiricom tapes lend themselves in this way. The conversations lend themselves to easily mouthed rather than pronounced conversation on the part of Dr. Mueller.
All right, we're going to jump ahead to track 8, Stephen.
Yeah.
And now this one is a new Spiricom audio clip. Tell us about this.
Yeah, you're correct. This is an example of how the higher fidelity, newly discovered Spiricom audio reveals so much more about what was going on in that lab with William O'Neill. You'll be able to hear, because of its high fidelity, you'll be able to hear where William O'Neill's voice and Mueller's voice complete each other's sentences, and instead of it being drowned out by the background noise, the clarity of this recording allows you to hear clearly what sounded like a mistake by a ventriloquist, not some psychic discarnate voice completing the sentence of a live man.
Here we go.
Well, I'll tell you what, sir. Why don't I shut the system down, switch over to this other RF generator, and see if it's stable now, sir.
He's talking to Mueller as if he's still alive.
Well, he sure is. And this, of course, is part of the Spiricom mythos, is that there's like a lab in a post fourth dimensional existence, and these technicians are giving real time help to create equipment to communicate with them. This is all part of the mythology around Spiricom that contributes to the modern day ITC mythology. Folks like Mark Macy, in fact, use that exact language of a time stream and technicians and imagining this other realm where they give direction to experimenters and operators of devices.
Track 9, another new Spiracom audio clip. O'Neill and Mueller are talking again, just a different phrase, right?
Yeah. Well, yes, but this is more interesting because you'll actually hear when you'll hear a little crosstalk when the phrase old equipment is stated. Listen closely. It sounds as if O'Neill must be in proximity of the tube or the electrolarynx device, because when he says old, those two O's are punctuated not only by his voice, but also by the Mueller voice, as if it might just be one person in the room in proximity of a device when he wants to imitate a Mueller voice.
Okay.
Yes, sir. Well, as I mentioned, sir, I'm going to shut this equipment down, change from this old equipment, as we call it, to this RF generator. Old equipment.
You know, to me, Stephen, listening to O'Neill, it sounds like an old guy who may or may not be whacked out, who is having fun doing what he's doing, and it sounds like he believes what he's doing.
And that's part of, at one level, what made it convincing for so many paranormal enthusiasts is that compelling part of it. It's clearly not, you know, he's not, chuckling along here. This is obviously what he considers to be.
He's serious.
A serious endeavor. Although, I must state, it's been recounted in the literature that the nature of the conversations is so trite, that's one problem almost everyone has with it. Like, if you had the opportunity to speak with someone that you truly believe to be dead, you wouldn't be having these ad nauseum conversations about tuning the dials and what diode to change.
I'd want to talk to my father's father, my grandfather, whom I never met. He died before I was born.
See, these are what you're saying. These are better rationales, and those would be better points, talking points in a conversation with a real dead person. But you can hear that it's kind of trite. It's mostly like ham radio talk. People are tuning dials, and some of the conversations not listed here tonight, but available on SpiritComStudy.com and elsewhere. They're about like cabbage and you know, what their favorite vegetables are and why you shouldn't smoke cigarettes. It's just so trite.
Art Bell's a ham, and I'll really freak if I hear his voice pop up on one of these things.
Oh, boy.
We're going to run the next three relatively close together, William. Give us just an overall synopsis of them.
Ah, well, I think it might be best, and you let me know, because you've got the schedule in front of you. But those phone calls from the dead, you remember I mentioned a Radova character much earlier.
Right.
Constantine Radova, who was featured in this book that as a kid I thought was fiction. It turns out there really was this Latvian psychologist who did this groundbreaking work called Breakthrough and popularized EVP in Europe, which eventually came to America as a phenomenon, a recognized phenomenon. This Radova figure is supposedly one of these time stream technicians, you see. And he actually had the opportunity to make a phone call from the dead. This is the alleged phone call from the dead. So Radova calls Meek, Radova calls others and leaves messages to triangulate his existence as proof. And it's very interesting that the nature of the phone calls is, again, not particularly insightful. And if I might say, the calls we can play actually paint a picture of a power grab within the paranormal community rather than a legitimate concern from some deceased entity. So we could actually state, before we play those, the context by way of seeing more about who Meek and O'Neill were, who could have influenced these calls to be made, because there's actually a strange NASA mind control connection to all of this, and it is not straining. It can be documented. It's not straining to bring those pieces in. So I, it's your call. We could go with them now and then fill in some of the blanks afterwards.
Okay, let's play the first one here.
Morning, this is George Meek.
This is Constantine Roudinger. George, my friend, at last we succeeded in contacting you. Jeanette is beside me, and she wants to give you all her love. This is Constantine Roudinger. This is the first contact you get from us.
Now, on any of these, Stephen, on any of them, does the voice that comes through talk about being dead?
No, that's a really good point, actually. It doesn't state the case. However, the fact that this voice is claiming to be that of Dr. Constantine Roudinger, who is known to have been dead for, you know, decades at that point, it's implicit, it's implied that would have been a phone call from the dead to George Meek in his last years of living. And what's almost cruel about that, unless, of course, you do believe it's a phone call from the dead, what's cruel about it is it talks about Meek's deceased wife being there and yet doesn't put her on the phone.
Yeah.
And it even says, we've contacted Mark and we must go now. And then the next track played will actually be a phone call from Constantine Roudinger explaining who they prefer to contact.
Okay, let's hear this one.
This is Constantine Roudinger speaking. We just tried to contact George Meek. We succeeded, but he didn't get what we wanted to tell him. Click Mark until you will have strengthened the bridge to our time stream.
You can hear the entire point of that call after the George Meek call was essentially to paint a picture of, we called George Meek, time stream, Constantine Roudinger has called George Meek, and we had to go because the connection wasn't strong enough. However, we call you, colleague Mark Macy, because we prefer to contact you. You know, that's the message of it. It's as if there's a paranormal power grab within these organizations by way of potentially hoaxed phone calls from the dead. Which brings us to an important kind of aspect of this is maybe some of this was inside job type psychological operations, a conspiracy from within. The connection from Spiracom back then to the contemporary Spiracom story is best outlined in a book by Dr. Patricia Kubis and Mark Macy. It's called Conversations Beyond the Light, in which the Spiracom story is prominently
heavily featured in that.
Featured, yes. Yeah. And so in this book, it states, by the way, this is written again by Dr. Patricia Kubis and Mark Macy. And Kubis in this book recounts her time at Orange Coast College. Okay, now, follow this chain of events. It's very interesting, this connection. Orange Coast College is the last place of employ for the Dr. Mueller on the Spiracom tapes when he was alive.
Interesting.
Uh-huh. So, and now, records reveal, when you go back to the faculty log books, you can open up a faculty log book and find... and this is posted on spearcomstudy.com, reproducing the researcher Guy Jackson, who originally discovered this overlap of employment, that Dr. Kubis, who co-authored the book with Mark Macy featuring the Spiracom story, worked concurrently with the Dr. Mueller purported to be on the Spiracom tapes. And check this out. Mark and she claimed to never have known that point till it was brought up to them within the past year. Now, I find that very hard to believe. And
how could they miss that?
Yeah. It's, it seems impossible. Now, I went through the trouble of interviewing via telephone, taped for posting, so she knew all about it. It was a legit telephone interview. She does claim to never have known him. She is quite aged, so I'm going to trust her recollection. But when folks like Mark Macy say that's not an important point, it's details. You know, let's stick to the mythology because it confirms our belief system. I think that's where we get into some of the difficult areas in this, as far as what responsibility do people have to look at the Spiracom story and the EVP ITC movement it's given birth to. Do we have a responsibility to look at this critically, even if it agrees with a given belief system? And I say we do, because there's been folks out there using devices just like old spirit mediums. I'm not saying, you know, they're all bad and fake, but there were plenty, and there are still plenty today, who are bilking paranormal enthusiasts and sometimes giving them false hope with devices that might show blurry pictures of supposedly their loved ones. It's just toying with people.
Yeah. Well, I think we have one more last clip here, Dan.
Oh, yes. Go ahead.
Do you have any messages that I can pass along to George Meek?
You know, I wanted to contact them all, but we here decided to contact you because you are the main experimentator and you are the manager, to say so. You are the person we want to address to. We prefer to contact you because this is the bridge that has been strengthened.
Yeah.
Here's the "we prefer to contact you" claim. It appears to be a paranormal power grab within this ITC community. And I know with the short time provided, there may not be much time to go into all the implications there, but I think it's obvious that if those are hoaxed phone calls from the dead, which would be my perspective, then someone must have been hoaxing them for some psychological operation purposes.
Such as
that power grab. See, Mark Macy claims to be the modern-day head of Metascience, claims to have bought the rights to Metascience. However, the real president of Metascience, who possesses all the files, all the technology of the Spiracom, is Thomas Pratt. And Thomas Pratt has got documentation, letters, pictures of he and Meek proving that he is, in fact, the legitimate head of Metascience. And yet, by way of these hoaxed phone calls from the dead, there appears to be a power grab to say, you know,
you're Meek, in charge, Mark.
Meek, step aside. Yeah. Macy's in charge.
Interesting. Oh my, oh my.
Uh-huh.
All your research got you to this conclusion, and I think you've got it right on. Is Metascience it's still in existence?
It is, and it's a labor of love for Thomas Pratt, because it's not a money-making organization. In fact, he pays fees for storage for all the Spiracom and Metascience materials. It's not a defunct organization, but it is not as active as it used to be in actual experimentation. Although Thomas Pratt is still a very well-read guy and stays on top of all that, and I've enjoyed greatly my informative conversations with him.
Great work. We're going to be back with you, Stephen. We're going to take phone calls with you next. Plus, we'll continue the dialogue because I want to, now that you gave us some possibilities of EVPs, I want to dive into that when we come back.